around 16 degrees in the cloudier spots. But as I say, if you do get some sunshine into the 20s, Sunday, it's a similar day. And in the sun, it should feel reasonably warm. Best will be in the east. Steve, back to you.
Not too bad then. Thank you very much, Thomas. Now on BBC Radio for our book of the week, a cautionary tale of poison, betrayal and greed. With the acquittal of young John, the public was very aware that no one had paid for the murder of George Bodle in Plumstead. And by the mid-1840s, it was popularly thought that arsenic poisoners were lurking everywhere. Julian Rhind Tutt reads from The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel.
The science of poisoning seems to have now been brought to so high a point of perfection that its operation baffles the eyes of ordinary observers, the Times believed. If you feel a deadly sensation within and grow gradually weaker, how do you know you are not poisoned? Asked the weekly newspaper, The Leader. If your hands tingle, do you not fancy it is arsenic? Your friends and relations all smile kindly upon you. The meal looks correct, but how can you possibly tell there is not arsenic in the curry? By enabling scientists to expose murders that might otherwise have gone undiscovered, James Marsh had unwittingly helped promote the idea that poisoners were everywhere, and danger lurked in every sip of milk and mouthful of stew. But Marsh's work was not the only reason for this suspicion. In 1836, the government dropped the tax on newspapers from 4 pennies to 1 penny. This coincided with a rapid increase in literacy rates among the working classes, opening up a mass market for cheap, breezy reading matter. Poisoning cases were reported with particular gusto. The upmarket papers also found that criminal poisoning was good for business. In 1856, when the Illustrated Times published a special edition on the trial of the Rugeley poisoner, Dr. William Palmer, whose victims were said to include his wife and several of his children, as well as a gambling friend, circulation was said to have doubled to 400,000. In the perceived poisoning epidemic engulfing the country, it was women who were most to be feared. They were scheming, duplicitous, and, though physically and politically weak, exercised terrifying power through their domination of the kitchen and the sick room. During the 1840s, nearly two-thirds of poisoning cases involved women defendants. Sarah Chesham, dubbed Sally Arsenic from Essex, was first arrested on suspicion of poisoning a farmer's illegitimate baby for cash. But soon the whispering began about the death of two of her own sons. The boys were exhumed, and Alfred Swain Taylor, the eminent toxicologist, told the inquest that Joseph's body contained enough arsenic to kill an adult, and James's enough to kill between 3 and 6. The Times, while conceding the inconvenient fact that Sarah had yet to be found guilty of anything, branded the whole community complicit in her crimes and said that, in an ignorant and secluded village of Essex lived a reputed poisoner, a woman whose employment was as well known as that of a nurse or washerwoman, who could put any disagreeable object out of the way. An accepted and reputed murderess walked abroad. When Sarah did stand trial for the deaths of her sons and the baby, to the surprise of many, not least presumably the editor of the Times, she was acquitted. 3 years later, Sarah's husband, Richard, sickened with vomiting and pains in his chest and abdomen. After his death, the doctors concluded that Richard had died of consumption. Superintendent Clark of the Essex Constabulary asked Swain Taylor to analyse some rice found in Sarah's kitchen cupboard. It contained no less than 12 to 16 grains of arsenic, Taylor said. He also found traces in Richard's stomach, but not enough to account for death, although arsenic in small doses would prove more deadly in someone already weakened by tuberculosis. The case was held up as a perfect example of what happened when the finer points of poisoning were revealed in novels and newspapers. At Sarah's first trial, a medical witness had described the effects of arsenic when administered under different conditions and circumstances. The Times reminded its readers, Sarah had stood quietly at the bar, listened and learned. If Sarah had indeed perfected her craft, it did her little good. A new witness came forward. Hannah Phillips claimed Sarah had offered to kill her abusive husband for her by seasoning a pie. This time, Sarah was found guilty. On the 24th of March, 1851, the Earl of Carlisle moved the third reading of his Sale of Arsenic Regulation Bill in the House of Lords. Now, as well as the druggist keeping a record of the purchaser's name, address, and reason for buying arsenic, the buyer would have to sign what became known as the Poison Book. But then the Earl slipped in a more fundamental proposal. He thought it expedient that it should be expressly enacted that arsenic should be sold to none but male adults. Carlisle's proposed amendment came to the notice of the philosopher and fearsome campaigner for the rights of the individual, John Stuart Mill, who wrote a strident letter to the Home Secretary. It was impossible to believe that so monstrous a proposition could have received government approval except through inadvertence. On the 5th of June, the Sale of Arsenic Regulation Bill received royal assent, but the men-only clause had been removed. By the 1840s, eminent toxicologists like Alfred Swain Taylor had been making regular appearances in the witness box. Their presence in the courtroom began to signify the importance of the case. They arrived with their specimen jars, glass tubes, and porcelain dishes to show the jury the tangible evidence of their findings. Here was a new breed of scientists, possessed of cutting-edge knowledge that enabled them to prove a murderer not only guilty beyond reasonable doubt, but beyond any doubt at all. By the time Thomas Smethurst stood trial, chemists had had over 20 years' experience with the Marsh test. But that was still not enough to prevent a debacle in this case. Smethurst, a 48-year-old doctor, a man of small and insignificant appearance with a reddish-brown moustache, left his elderly wife and went through a fake marriage with Isabella Banks, who was in her 40s, had a private income and a large life insurance policy. The pair moved into lodgings on Richmond Green in Surrey, and a few months later, Isabella began to suffer bouts of vomiting and diarrhoea. The doctors sent a sample of her vomit to Alfred Swain Taylor, who said his tests recovered a metallic deposit that he thought was either arsenic or antimony. Smethurst was promptly arrested. Isabella died the next day. Taylor then turned his attention to the large number of medicine bottles in Isabella's bedroom. All the potions appeared innocent, except one. Bottle 21 contained chlorate of potash, an innocent diuretic mixed with arsenic. He had never come across such a combination, and there was no medical reason for prescribing it. Smethurst was duly charged with murder. Seven doctors appeared for the defence and 10 for the prosecution, including Alfred Swain Taylor. Taylor told the court that he could ascribe the death to nothing but the action of irritant poison. On the second day of the trial, however, Taylor was forced to enter the Old Bailey witness box with an embarrassing tale. He had carried out more experiments and consulted colleagues. From the copper I used in my experiment on bottle number 21, I actually deposited arsenic myself in the liquid that remained, he told the court. Arsenic was known to be an impurity in raw copper, but scientists believed it was eliminated during the refinement process. Clearly this was not always so, and in this case the copper had dissolved, thereby freeing the arsenic. Summing up for the defence, Mr. Parry referred to the terrible mistake made by Dr. Taylor. This was the man who had stated in the magistrate's court that he had found arsenic in a bottle in Smethurst's possession. That evidence alone would have been enough to send the accused to the scaffold. Despite Taylor's evidence being false, the jury clearly didn't like the cut of Smethurst's jib and found him guilty. Certainly he had behaved suspiciously, refusing to let Isabella's sister see her and dragging a solicitor out on a Sunday to draw up her will, which left everything to him. A huge outcry followed the verdict, however. The general consensus was that Smethurst, though obviously a bounder, was not a proven murderer. 30 doctors wrote to the Home Secretary to say, "There is no proof worthy of belief that arsenic was found in the deceased, and still less that death was produced by poison." 28 barristers also protested that the evidence did not warrant the verdict. Thomas Smethurst received a reprieve 4 days before he was due to hang, and was charged with bigamy instead. The heavens then fell upon the hapless Swain Taylor. The Dublin medical press said, "He has brought his profession into a disrepute that years would not remove. All that remains for him now is to withdraw into obscurity, not forgetting to take his arsenical copper with him." The mudslinging within the profession was on an industrial scale. The editor of the British Medical Journal wished a plague on all their houses. The public watched as professional men stabbed each other's reputations over the bodies of malefactors. The Smethurst case set back the cause of forensic toxicology and damaged the credibility of the expert scientific witness for years to come. On the 20th of February, 1844, The Times carried a small news story under the headline, "The Murder at Plumstead." "We understand that John Bodle, who was found guilty on Tuesday last, under the alias of James Smith, and sentenced to 20 years transportation for extorting money, and who about 10 years ago was tried for the murder of his grandfather by poison, has confessed since his confinement in Newgate that he did commit that murder, and that no one but himself was concerned in the horrid transaction." Under the double jeopardy rule, young John, once acquitted, could not be tried again for the same offence. His father, Middle John, had stated on his deathbed that he had left the world unstained by crime. And his mother, Catherine, was also said to have made a deathbed statement about the murder. The rumours circulating in Plumstead and Woolwich about Mrs. Bodle's last words were vague, but according to one resident, it was generally understood that she exonerated her husband from the guilt and threw it upon her errant and unnatural son. On the 22nd of April, 1844, the bark Maria Soames set sail for Van Diemen's Land, with 264 male prisoners on board. Among the prisoners is that well-known character in Plumstead and Woolwich named John Bodle, reported John Bull magazine. Once he reached Australia, John Bodle, along with his alter ego James Smith, vanished without a trace.
Julian Rhind Tutt was reading the final part of The Inheritor's Powder by Sandra Hempel, abridged by Libby Spurrier. It was a peer production for BBC Radio 4, and the producer was David Blount. We'll stay in the 19th century for our next book of the week, a biography of the woman who single-handedly dragged China into modernity, Empress Dowager Cixi. That begins on Monday. Now, though, we're off to sea. And now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 21st of September. There are warnings of gales in Bailey, Faroes and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, low 50 miles southwest of Iceland 988, expected 180 miles northeast of Iceland 995 by 1800 Saturday. High 140 miles west of Fitzroy 1024, expected Biscay 1027 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours, Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, 40s, Cromarty, 4th. Southerly or southwesterly, 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in Viking and North Utsira. Rain or thundery showers, good, occasionally poor. Tyne, Dogger, Fisher, German Bight, southwest 4 or 5, mainly fair, good, occasionally poor later.